You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
From Vineyard Theater in New York City, this is Theater Uncorked, where Vineyard artists come together to talk about the process of bringing new works to the stage. I'm your host, Eric Pargotch. For episode 7, we are joined by legendary composer John Kander, Tony-nominated book writer David Thompson, and 5-time Tony Award-winning director and choreographer Susan Stroman. In 1987, John Kander and his late writing partner Fred Ebb, who were responsible for such iconic musicals as Chicago and Cabaret, took a chance on a young creative team that included Susan Stroman and David Thompson. Kander and Ebb agreed to let the team do a revival of their musical Flora the Red Menace here at the Vineyard. It was a wonderful experience for all of them, and Kander, Ebb, Thompson, and Stroman went on to collaborate on several projects throughout the years, including And the World Goes Round and Steel Pier. They returned to the Vineyard in 2010 for the world premiere of The Scottsboro Boys, which was begun with Fred Ebb, but completed after he passed away. Since that experience on The Scottsboro Boys, John Kander has been happy to call the Vineyard his artistic home, premiering his musicals Kid Victory and The Landing here, which he created with his new writing partner, Greg Pierce. David Thompson, a Tony Award nominee for Steel Pier, has become an active member of the Vineyard's Artistic Council, advocating for the company and helping the Vineyard raise money. Susan Stroman, who directed and choreographed such Tony Award-winning musicals as Bullets Over Broadway and The Producers, winner of a record-making 12 Tony Awards, has also maintained strong Vineyard ties, directing her first straight play Dot by Coleman Domingo on our stage. The Vineyard also created an award in her name, the Susan Stroman Directing Award, a biennial residency-based award granted to talented early or mid-career directors. The team has come together again at the Vineyard with The Beast in the Jungle, an innovative and original new dance play starring Tony Award nominee Tony Yazbek and former American Ballet principal dancer Arina Dvorovenko. We are thrilled the three of them could join us during tech rehearsals of The Beast in the Jungle. The production, which opened May 23rd, has gone on to delight audiences and has been critically celebrated as extraordinarily creative and stunningly portrayed by Newsday, with The Wrap saying, "Boy, does this production and Kander's gorgeous music have a lot to show for itself." And now, this is John Kander, David Thompson, and Susan Stroman in Theater Uncorked at The Vineyard.
How we met, well, that's interesting because we really, we knew each other, but we really bonded here at the Vineyard. We had mutual friends in Scott Ellis, and at one point, certainly Scott Ellis and I wanted to be on the other side of the table. We wanted to create for the theater, and I had done the national tour of Chicago, and Scott Ellis had done The Rink, and so Scott knew Kander and Ebb. I knew them a little bit from the tour, but when Scott Ellis and I were doing a Broadway show that lasted, I think, a week on Broadway called Musical Chairs.
I saw that.
Oh, my gosh. And we decided that we would be brave and ask Candor Neb if we could take one of their shows and create it in a new way off Broadway. And Scott Ellis was very good friends with Tommy Thompson. Which is David Thompson, but we call him Tommy Thompson. We're not sure why, but and so Tommy and Scott and I and went to Candor Neb, and we thought, what's the worst thing that could happen? They could say no, but in fact, they said yes. So we took one of their shows, Flora the Red Menace, to the Vineyard, and Tommy reworked it in the form of WPA Theater, which was perfect for the Vineyard. But it was not only a way for us to get started in the theater. We were very young at the time, of course, and also to be creators, not to be performers. I think that's what we wanted more than anything to create. But it bonded us into a great friendship with Candor Neb, and here we are today sitting with John Candor in the office, but 30 years later, or is it more, maybe?
It feels like longer.
Feels like, but we, from that experience, and that started at the Vineyard, we have become best of friends, and it's been a wonderful journey to have created now many shows, and now ultimately here with The Beast in the Jungle.
Yeah, it was actually a wonderful experience, Flora the Red Menace. Working at the Vineyard, it was an opportunity to try out what we could do in a very small space in a theater with a wonderful sense of what it wanted from its artists. And it was a fun project, but mostly it was fun because it gave us a chance with John and Fred to really begin to learn the craft of how to go about working on a musical from the other side of the table where you were really inventing it. What was wonderful about it is no matter what we came back with in our ideas, John and Fred were right there for us of how to bring it to life. And for that reason, it was quite a learning experience, but one that was very important. It was a great place to start.
The element that is never discussed in this reminiscence is that Flora the Red Menace was a flop on Broadway. And when these talented people approached us with the idea of redoing it, we were thrilled. The idea that somehow or other we could figure out a way to do it right was extremely attractive, particularly with these people that we liked, which we came to love, really. And it was a very selfish decision that we made.
And right after that, we went on to create And the World Goes Round, which is a retrospective of Candor Neb's work. And so it was more the excitement of being able to continue to work with John and Fred right after that.
Well, I remember, John, you had said Flora had been such a wonderful experience, and you said, you know, they're not always like this. This is something that's kind of rare. We had a really great time. It's not always like this. And I think that was your way of saying, look for those moments in the theater where you can love them and you can enjoy them and they can mean something, because that's really the measure of what it means to work in the theater. And and ultimately that's become, I think, something that on any project we've ever done is try to make sure that that always remains front and center.
And I still feel that. I feel that more today than ever. Maybe it's because I'm so ancient, but the idea of why do it if you're not going to have a happy creative experience. And we have, I should say, and we do, and we have, and that continues.
The difference in the Scottsboro Boys is, of course, Fred Ebb was very much a part of that and the development of it. And what we started that idea, we were once again looking for a project to do, and we wanted to find something that was based on a true American event, an incident and to do that, we looked at different court cases. And the one that sprung to mind immediately was the Scottsboro Boys, which was a trial that we had stumbled across in history when we were looking at information for background information on both Flora the Red Menace and Steel Pier. But it was a story that was very compelling, and we thought that would be something that would be very interesting to bring to the stage because it would mean something, would have something to say. And it was it was a project, I think we came, it came together very quickly, and then it was put on a shelf for a few years until we figured out what to do with it after Fred had died. But it was a project I think we never lost faith in on any level. We always knew that it would come to the stage, and we just had to wait for it to find its path.
Do you remember when we actually started it?
It was in about 2000 or 1999, which is a long time ago. But I remember starting it around that time, and it was something that once we had brought into the whole creative discussion, the idea of using a minstrel show as a format, the writing was very quick. It was very swift. Fred was always ahead of us. He was always angry with us because we weren't as fast as he was, because he loved the project. He loved everything about it. You remember him, you know, just saying, I'm two songs ahead. I'm four scenes. I'm a whole act ahead of you. And what's wrong with you all? And we would always be trying to catch up with Fred. It was something he felt very impassioned about.
I'm not going to discuss that.
But it was something that when it did come together, it was very quick. And then when Fred died, we did put it on the shelf. And until Kander, you said, let's take a look at it again. Let's see what we can do with this.
And when Kander said that, we got together and realized a lot had been written. And Kander finished the score, finished the entire piece. And when we felt we had it at a good place, we thought, where can we take it?
That's right.
So we called Doug Abel at the Vineyard and said, would you read this? And if we got a group of actors together, maybe listen to it. And he right away, he loved it and thought it had great possibilities. But also, Doug is a wonderful dramaturg, is very helpful.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And he did give us a reading, indeed a reading with all the actors. And it was the beginning of something that he then fell in love with and wanted to produce. So we ended up back at the Vineyard again with the Scottsboro Boys.
What was great about Doug, though, is he was so clear-headed about what we needed to do in order to take a form that was a little bit... we had to be very clear about why and how we were using it. And Doug was instrumental in making sure we had found the balance between what was entertaining and what was very dramatic. And that was something I remember all the conversations with him about that.
Yeah, he was very useful. And in my life in this business, I have found that people who are producers are often not very smart about in the advice that they give to the creative people. And it's quite the reverse with Doug. I don't think I've ever heard Doug make a suggestion that wasn't worth thinking about.
Yeah, especially in that process, that writing process, because it was something that it had a lot to say, and it was something that you had to lean into and you could never back away from. And the minute you started to retreat from the audacity of the idea, you were in danger of losing it. So it took a lot of, you know, he was always there to make sure that we never in any way didn't deliver what we set out to do.
Bringing the show here, also the Scottsboro Boys to the Vineyard, was, you know, the Vineyard audience, very smart, they're very savvy, they come here to see interesting theater. You know, the Vineyard has set it up that they are brave and take chances. And so it is an institution that is different from many others in New York. And so when we're here, we feel somewhat protected in a way just because of the support and the bravery of the idea of taking chances that might not be mainstream, but certainly entertaining to the Vineyard audience.
Well, it's difficult putting together a new musical. It's difficult enough, but if you're looking to tell a story that might not fit into a mainstream format or idea of what a musical is supposed to be, but you're still willing to back it 100% and never back away from that support, that's very rare.
I've done six shows here, and in none of those projects have I ever felt a commercial pressure from anybody. It's always with both Doug and Sarah. It's always been about the piece and bringing a new work to its best possible completion.
It was a wonderful project to work on because it was a very galvanizing project. It had an incredible company who were so compelled to tell that story. And as it moved through its process, I mean, they really launched that piece, and it's had a life outside the vineyard and beyond, but I think it would never have had that life had it not had that incredible team.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Around it. With The Beast in the Jungle, we were once again looking for a project that we could work on. And we had all read the Henry James, The Beast in the Jungle, and we had been attracted to it because it was a story about a man looking back on three chapters on his life. And it was that cautionary tale in his life of what happens when you miss those opportunities or you miss those chances to connect, in this case, with a woman. We thought this was a very powerful story. And actually, Stroh had the idea of taking it and bringing it to a contemporary time. And at that point, we really left the Henry James behind in order to make it a story that would really, that a contemporary audience could connect with. Because it is that cautionary tale of what happens when you do miss opportunities in your life and you do come to that point in your life at the end of your life where you might realize you hadn't actually lived your life, that you had somehow missed it. And somehow that story seemed something that all three of us felt was worth telling, and telling in a new way, in a way that really was unencumbered by anything we might have ever done in the past. But that's where it started. That was the original inspiration for it.
It's funny. It deviates from the outline of the story considerably, but it's in essence exactly what the story is about. So it's our own way of sort of digesting the Henry James and then telling the same story in our own way.
Well, when we started this piece too, we thought, what if it was told with almost like a dance play, where the idea of somebody who waltzing through life. And when we came to that thought, of course, John Kander jumped on it right away, the idea of writing an entire score in three-quarter time. He lit up, and in fact, so much so that he would write a different waltz every night, and it would end up on my phone in the morning. So I would wake up to a John Kander waltz on my iPhone, and I thought, what a lucky girl I am. But he really immersed himself in the waltzes, and until we finally had ourselves a really good storyline, and then he started to write waltzes for those particular emotions and situations.
I've said this often, when we decided that it was going to be all waltzes, I asked Stroh, how much do I have to pay you to let me write this score?
I know. We've had a wonderful time because, and also what Kander's written in three-quarter time, it's still John Kander, but it seems unique to me. I've never heard anything like it. So I think the piece has a unique quality about it. The plot is driven by narration, but also by the dance and by the music. And it has just a very unique look to it. And I think the Vineyard's the perfect place to do this.
Well, it's interesting, though. It is of different form now that we look back on it. If you were to go back to the point where we were actually initially talking about it, nobody ever starts a conversation thinking they're going to do something different in the form that if you did, I think you would be lying that you ever really had that much forethought. But looking at what we now have on the stage, it's a different use of those storytelling devices, whether it is through the dialogue or a dramatic situation or the way dance is used to propel the story and specifically the music.
I think one of the things that was fun about the creation of this was, and it was a lot of conversations at Stroh's studio, which is, when do we dance? When do we talk? When do we do both? And since we were starting this piece with no preconceptions or even the vaguest idea how to do it, everything was possible. And what could be more fun than that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that I have to say about this piece that's been particularly exciting is it's finding the place where the only thing you can do is dance, or the only thing you can do is somehow have a scene with somebody, or the only thing you can do is put it into music. And it's you're still following, I wouldn't say the rules, you're still following the inspiration behind a musical, but at no point does anybody turn around and start singing. There's no sung action.
There's nothing bad about singing. I would just like to remove that little bit of sarcasm. But the fact is, we were finding, when did it seem right for somebody to narrate? Or when did it seem right to somebody to actually play a scene? Or when should you do a scene in dance? Or when do you do all of it at the same time? And we just had a great time finding that out.
And we have our wonderful set and costume designer, Michael Curry. When we started to work with him too, it's being created sort of in an abstract world. And he's a master at doing that, all of a sudden making an ocean on stage out of some silk, or making a river, or making a bird fly out of the dark into the light. And he is very, very imaginative, and all of a sudden took our script and made it come to life in also a unique way. It is a cautionary tale, and it is it lives in both worlds, as a hopeful world and a world of that is sad for someone who did miss every cue and use some sort of an excuse to not live his life. We use the idea of a beast as someone, we know a lot of people who have a beast inside them, and what it is really an excuse not to somehow go forward or live their life to the fullest. And this particular story, of course, involves a man who has a beast, and we see the three chapters of his life of how he more or less uses that as an excuse. And
to keep from connecting with the woman of the love of his life, a woman that he has met very only in three different chapters of his life, but has provided him with a sense of passion and wanting something, but ultimately his inability to connect and to go to the next step.
I must say, even when I was much younger, the idea of reaching the end of your life and looking back at it and thinking, I missed it, is one of the saddest things that I can conceive of. And that's the story we're telling.
The great thing about it, though, is also it allows us to look at the talents of our cast in different ways. I mean, you wouldn't normally have a cast that would include an actor like Peter Friedman, who is so skilled and has such command in this kind of a piece, where you also have a ballerina, Arina Dvorovenko, who is an absolutely beautiful prima ballerina, a star who is able to also carry as much dramatic weight as she does, or somebody like Tony Azbeck, who's able to bridge both the world of dance and in many different forms. So everybody that's on stage is used in a different way in doing something that you wouldn't typically see. The development process for Beast in the Jungle was very accelerated. Once we knew what we wanted to do, it came together very quickly. We were fortunate enough to have two workshops, which allowed us to do a couple things. One is to find a musical the way the music, well, sure, you should talk about this, but when you're doing something with dance, the music and the dance take a little bit more time than you would ever have in a typical musical. It requires a lot more preparation.
Well, I think when dance is involved, John Kander will write this beautiful melody, and which is appropriate for the situation and the scene, and then I need to choreograph it, so I need to ask him, well, now I need, you know, 10 more bars of this or 8 more bars of that, and I, you know, can you modulate here, because I'm going to leap in the air right here. So then the music has to be arranged. So Kander writes it in the purest form, and then it's arranged for the choreography. What's wonderful about what John Kander does is that he's very visual when he writes. So I can say to him, I see two people on the beach in Pompeii falling in love, and it comes out of his fingers onto the keyboard, and that is the music, and the music says there are two people in Pompeii falling in love.
That's because I've had so much experience falling in love on the beach at Pompeii.
Oh, I see. It all comes out now.
But it is remarkable, though. I mean, you can, as an author, just have characters talk about it, but it's another thing to actually have it represented in music or in movement, and that is the part where it really lifts. But it is what Kander's bringing to it is incredible.
One thing, well, as we speak about this, another element that we were very fortunate about is that Sam Davis, who did the orchestrations, also was there every day working with Stroh in the dance arrangements. And so when he came to orchestrate, he already knew the piece as well as any of us. So he's in a funny way, a fourth collaborator in this.
Yes.
And his work is absolutely brilliant. And fortunately, and it doesn't always happen like this, with the three of us and Sam, it all sounds as if it was done by one person.
Yeah.
And that's when you can feel great satisfaction.
I mean, you'll see on the stage that the choreography is supported by the music. When they leap in the air, so does the orchestra. When they, you know, do a tap step, so does the orchestra. It's completely supported by the music.
Yeah, what is also great about it, though, in the use of the music is now that the orchestra is coming into the mix in rehearsals, to be able to hear that sound that really defines the personality of the piece. Well, how would you describe it? It's not orchestral in that it sounds like there's 100 pieces, but it has its own sense of life.
The orchestra is nine pieces, and it was the approach to orchestrating was that it was never to sound like an apology for that we didn't have a big orchestra. It was always to be a piece of chamber music where you can have duets, you can have solos, you have little trios, and sometimes even when all nine, that sounds so funny, all nine of our players are playing, it still sounds like a chamber music approach, not an excuse for not having a big orchestra. And because of that, and I, again, hats off to Sam, it's kind of pure in that way. This whole collaboration is that we all feed each other, and it's what collaboration is supposed to be like, and sometimes is, but sometimes is not.
And we're certainly inspired by the actors and their talents, and I feel like we've tapped into sort of the best of what they do. Yet, in the same breath, I want to say they are also challenged by this material. So I feel like we've been able to use what they do best, but now ask them to stretch themselves. Irina is a magnificent ballet dancer, but has wonderful acting chops. And so Kander's able to write beautiful lyrical music for her. And then Tommy's able to write these very, very dramatic scenes. And so she's doing what she knows, but then is now stretching herself. Tony Azbeck, incredible dancer, rhythmic, magnetic. He's like a walking drummer. He's filled with rhythm and passion, and you know, he's such a star. He is now being asked to do that, to dance with great rhythm, but now also dance very lyrical. And in a lyrical way with this wonderful ballerina, and asked to do two parts. He's asked to play young Marcher, which is a young version of Peter Friedman, and then the nephew, which is Peter Friedman's nephew, or adult Marcher's nephew. So he plays two different characters. So I feel like it's a piece that's asking Tony also to stretch. And then Peter Friedman now, who is a wonderful actor with weight and gravitas and great command, is now being thrust in the middle of music. So now he is being challenged. So I think for all of us to do this sort of new form for all of us has been wonderful, because it has just made us all grow.
The experience has been and continues to be wonderful. And with all of our various gifts and approaches to it, when you get right down to it, it's really Stroh.
Oh, it is. Brother.
I mean... Oh, brother. Oh, that means I'm paying for dinner, I think.
No, but it's true.
No, I'm paying for dinner, I guess. Or I'll slip you $20 after this is over.
No, I'd rather have dinner.
Okay.
Well, that's it for Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard. Thanks to John Kander, David Thompson, and Susan Stroman for joining us on the podcast. Theater Uncorked is produced and edited by me, Eric Pargach, Vineyard Theater's Director of Communications and New Media, with help from our associate producer, Ali Sky Bennett, and Marketing Director, Melissa Pelkey. Thanks to the Vineyard's Artistic Directors, Douglas Abel and Sarah Stern, and our Managing Director, Suzanne Appel, along with the entire Vineyard staff. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and rate and review us on iTunes. It helps spread the word. And last but not least, thanks to you for listening to Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.